From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, we take a look at the end of the Soviet Union and points beyond. Luciana, we have an interesting topic to cover today. This is the essentially the destruction of the Soviet economy by under Gorbachev primarily, and the removal of the Communist Party as the primary political player. They're the exclusive role of the Communist Party being surrendered. And then the entire apparatus essentially being handed over to Boris Yeltsin in a strange Marxian exercise, Gorbachev having destroyed the state and the party, himself withered away.
Yes, indeed.
And then we go to shock therapy. And we go to shock therapy, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. The withering away of the state, but not in a good way.
Right.
So that's exactly right. I think it had been George Kennan or somebody in the... I'm pretty sure it was George Kennan, who said that if you destroy the Communist Party of Russia, of the Soviet Union, then you could destroy everything else. So Gorbachev did that. I mean, there was a kind of campaign in the 1980s, in which communism was sort of on the accusing block, and so was Lenin, and there was an ideological weakening before. A campaign for an ideological weakening. In other words, weakening of the ideology that had been the source of pride, the ideology that had instilled pride, courage, looking forward for ever since 1917 in Russians. There was a disorientation of the ideology in which Soviet Union had lived. And then, through these subtle attacks and the rehabilitation of people that had been traitors and condemned during the Moscow trials, particularly Bukharin, so there was this destabilization of the ideological mind in the Soviet Union with Gorbachev, and then came as the attack on the very institution of the Communist Party. And then once that was gone, as you said, it was easy to change, to kill the socialist economy. I'm trying to remember something that's important, Gorbachev eliminated central planning. So not only did he deinstitutionalize the state, attack the ideology, attack the institution, but also the economic base of the structure of the economic structure of the Soviet Union, of the social economic structure of the Soviet Union. So all pieces were in place for what followed, which in 1996, mid-90s, but especially 1996, resulted in economic shock therapy. That is the ideology of the West, of Milton Friedman, free to choose, privatization, no restraint by the state on the market, on trade, etc. So economic shock therapy came under the Yeltsin second in full under Yeltsin's second mandate, which was engineered and rigged by the United States, his second election. And it's not a secret. It's all over the place. So it was a coup. Yeltsin's 1996 election was a coup. So what I call the neoliberal Great Terror, to contrast it with what in the West is called Stalin's Great Terror, the neoliberal Great Terror came to the Soviet Union. It is known as shock therapy. So between 1992 and 2000, there were between 5 and 6 million surplus deaths. 170,000 people were victims of murder or murdered. The GDP fell by 50%. And this was a higher drop than during the German occupation of the parts of the Soviet Union that Germany occupied. 70 million fell into poverty. Death rates increased by 60%, sort of like countries at war. Life expectancy decreased in males to age 57. Abortions increased spectacularly. Birth rates fell. There were suicides, the resurgence of illnesses that had been eradicated, like measles and diphtheria and tuberculosis. So, you know, some observers, some analysts have said that in Russia, under shock therapy reforms, Russia became the site of an economic genocide. So Yeltsin's Russia was a disaster. He plundered Russian assets and gave rise to a new class of oligarchs. But Washington considered Yeltsin a Democrat and this plunder a progress. So Russia sank in an economic depression, into poverty, starvation, unemployment, social insecurity, and finally defaulted on the debt to bloodsuckers like the IMF and the European banks, etc., in 1999, which is 1 year before Putin assumed the presidency again. But this human disaster is never acknowledged in the United States. They simply ignore it. And yet this was the kind of Russia for which the United States rigged the 1996 elections to keep Yeltsin in power. Did you want to comment on this?
No, this is good history. Let's take this in first. People need this.
Okay, so now we know that the U.S., the West, interfered and changed the economy of the Soviet Union with help from inside. For example, to give one example, Yeltsin's acting prime minister was a guy named Yegor Gaidar. And he was the architect of the shock therapy. He was a young economist. He wrote for Pravda. He was a Communist Party member and supposedly an intellectual. But he obviously had converted to Milton Friedman's free to choose economics. And he was a turncoat, basically. Yep. And there were many of these. Now, the question is, going back to 1956 and Khrushchev's demonization of Stalin by accusing Stalin of having cultivated a cult of personality, I think that we have said that Khrushchev began this opening partially because he started decentralizing power, giving sort of unexamined autonomies to local agricultural, for example, consortia, etc. But in and also he Khrushchev began this path toward we no longer have a class war. The result of that is that a class of oligarchs were actually waiting in the shadow to prowl and to rob the assets of the people. When he said we are a nation of people, there is no more class differences, and then he said there is no more conflict really with the West, we can get along, when this was all contrary to reality, because at the same time the Western countries, France for example, was putting down both the Indochina anti-colonial struggle and was beginning to put down the Algerian anti-colonial struggle. That's just talking about France.
Right.
And soon, at the same time, as soon as France lost Indochina in 1954, the United States stepped in and it began the path toward the Vietnam War. So imperialism was well alive, not to mention that in Western Europe, NATO was formed. This was under Khrushchev's eyes.
Well, not only that, and also, I mean, almost simultaneously, it was within a year of the Indochina thing for France, the Bandung Conference, which was the opening shot in the uprising by the colonies against the colonialism. And so to say that the class war was over as some of the first shots were being fired, it was absurd, obviously.
That's right. It was absurd, but it was very convenient to the class.
That's correct.
That Khrushchev was actually supporting the petty bourgeoisie, essentially, and supporting, and that would grow in strength, thrive in the shadow, become the second economy.
Yep.
Unregulated, Gosplan, the central planning was weakened, further under Brezhnev. And so we have this path toward a loss of ideological, what would you call it, ideological education? Ideological education. And then another irony under Khrushchev opening, sort of an early glasnost, was that Soviet citizens who were enjoying all sorts of social service advantages, you know, full employment, etc., education, health, because of the influx of goods from the West, importing goods and stuff, and seeing the stuff that was going on in the West, they began to compare themselves, their status, to the Western style, and forgot that they were an alternative. Socialism was an alternative to that. They were, you know, to that way of life, to capitalism, and began to yearn for things that they didn't have.
You know, so, you had some real weapons that were brought to bear here. I'm gonna sort of just move into Khrushchev's term and come forward a little bit and set a couple of things in motion, or describe a couple things that were in motion. No, it's all right. One thing is that even though the ruble was fixed and there were several adjustments of it, three or four close to the revolution, and then one that lasted from the early 30s until the post-war period, and another from the post-war, like 47 or something, up until the early mid-60s, you know, evaluations and revaluations of it, but it was pegged to gold. And the Soviet Union actually had gold reserves that it was pegged mm-hmm. to. But the West refused to allow trade in rubles with the they wouldn't take rubles in Western mm-hmm. banks. Mm-hmm. So the Soviet Union, which of course had its economy first built up from scratch, from feudalism, while at war from 1917 to 1924, and then rapidly trying to stay ahead of the coming war from the mid-late 20s until the war, then had its economy destroyed again, then found itself encircled with a bunch of destroyed countries as buffers and also as clients whose people were expecting goods and services, built a rather impressive economy in short order that included an economy that could support the first space travel. all of that was going on, and the currency was not acceptable. And what that meant was whatever they did not make inside that economy, there was no way for people to obtain it from the outside. If you won't take my money, I can't buy your stuff. That's what that was about. Now, people didn't, the economy was organized differently, and partly because of the exigencies of the previous history, but there were also some public policy decisions that were made that actually are pretty forward-looking. People, when I was there in 1990 in Moscow, complained that they couldn't afford a car. They had fantastic mass transit, however. I was like, what do you want a car for? So, anyone who lives in New York City that has a car, you know, they look at it as an albatross. You know, it's oh my God, I have to find a place to park this thing.
I didn't know how to drive until I came out here in the country. Right. In New York, I didn't need to drive.
Why would you? It was a burden. A lot of things like that were not, you know, part of the economy. And so, if you wanted to buy a car from the United States or Japan or Germany or whatever, and you're an average citizen, you couldn't buy it. Or if they didn't make electronic tape recorders to your specifications or some other consumer goods, because they couldn't make everything because there's only one country and a couple of neighboring pals. But they were doing pretty damn well. So what happened in 1964 was the creation of this thing called Beryozka stores. They were like an alternative. And if you had, at Beryozka store, you could, if you had hard currency, you could go in and buy like a Japanese tape recorder or camera or American jeans. That was a big item. Different things that you couldn't buy, you know, that weren't made locally. Some of the things were made locally, but, you know, they made pants, for example, in the Soviet Union, obviously, or there'd be a lot more people there. They didn't make Levi's blue jeans. Well, some places did, actually, or, you know, bootleg. But so if you wanted those, and then you had like a, you know, counterculture, quote unquote, that was, you know, pimping for a lot of these designers and everything else like they were doing here. So you had kids, I must have Levi's jeans. You know how that fashion thing works. They'd have to go figure out where to get some hard currency. Well, the tourists have hard currency that come to the Soviet Union. So what started happening was people started taking whatever they could put their hands on and selling it to tourists so they could buy stuff in the Beryozka stores. Meanwhile, as this phenomenon was developing, the governments of Khrushchev, then Brezhnev, and a few others, they start expanding the Beryozka stores. So what starts happening? Well, I'm the guy that delivers the tomatoes from the farm outside Moscow to the market in downtown Moscow. Twice a week, the tomatoes fall off the truck, and somehow they end up in the hands of this guy who's behind the in-tourist hotel saying, "Hey, tomatoes." And he sells them for dollars or marks or pounds or crowns or whatever, Western currencies. they split that up between them, and then they go to Berioska store and buy blue jeans or whatever it was that they were after that they couldn't find in their own stores. What started happening was the shelves of the stores in the Soviet Union started to thin out because all of the goods were being diverted by a class of thieves, basically, that were being promoted, that both organized by the West and, you know, through the, you know, the intelligence agencies and business people, because people making money on it. I mean, we know the story of the CIA and cocaine sales, for example, or weapons trading. They're business people for sure. And they hollowed out the economy. And what happens when you hollow out the economy is you lose the support of the public. People are going to work. They're growing the tomatoes. How come there's no tomatoes in the store? I worked on the farm all summer. What the hell is that? And as that happens, you've got a guy who's the same guy's, by the time you're with Gorbachev, riding the top of the political apparatus and starts loosening the power of the Communist Party, which is where the only remedy to that situation could potentially lie. And so now you end up at this situation where the state collapses, the economy is in shambles, people that haven't stolen everything yet are stealing what's left, and then they bring in the consultants from the West to tell them what to do. And you get a guy like Gaidar and a drunk like Yeltsin to front for him, and then that's what we had. That's where we are now.
Yeah. Precisely, and there are many other things.
It was very complex.
That unraveled with interference and collaboration. Gorbachev, by the way, comes from the on the edge of the North Caucasus. That's where this kind of second economy developed in the mafias. He comes from Stavropoulos, right? Stavropoulos?
I don't remember where he comes from. Yeah.
And he comes from, you know, petty bourgeois agrarian background. So, but in addition to the primary goal, destroy the Communist Party, weaken the ideology, and then destroy the party, then bring in market economies, and then what Yeltsin was a white Russian nationalist. That is, look here. We spend all this money on these stupid states like Poland and in the East and these Asiatic republics. All our money, all our stuff goes there. So we need to become Russia again. We need. So it was a kind of Russian nationalism.
Right.
That in a reactionary sort of way, because what had to be done during the Soviet years was to actually control Russian nationalism, because it was 50% of the population, 50% of the 90% of the expertise. And this was all lent out to the socialist republics.
Right.
Money, industrialization, advisors, engineers, Russian, etc.
Right.
And then the West accuses Russia of being an empire.
The empire.
When in fact the center, if you want to call it Russia, the center, was bleeding, and it's a negative term, but was in infusing capital in its periphery.
That's
in its
correct.
Outer.
It was the opposite. The flow, if you were looking at the economic flows, it was the opposite of what happens in a colonial or an imperialist situation.
And that, ironically, was exploited by Yeltsin, which, you know, this way it gave way to the breakaway of the republics that had themselves, cultivated a elite class that was for selfish reasons, yep. nationalist.
Yep.
And it just incredible. So the U.S. helped in this, and I want to recount if we have a minute.
Yeah, we have a couple minutes. I just wanted one extra piece of history here. In 1990, Yeltsin was elected to the Congress of People's Deputies of Russia. I'm kidding, of the Russian Federal Republic. In May 29th of 1990, which is the first day I arrived in the Soviet Union by coincidence, he was elected chair of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the RSFSR, of Russia, in essence. And what ended up happening was there was a power struggle between the people in the RSFSR and the parallel structures of the Soviet Union. And so these power-hungry nationalists, the power-hungry guys in the RSFSR, including Yeltsin, pitched nationalism, what you just described, basically, to the public. And that was how they got a little bit of... They didn't have public support for withdrawing from the Soviet Union, but that was their cover, was stoking exactly that.
That's right. The referendum of the spring of 1991...
Right.
The people voted, with the exception of a few republics, until I think the Baltics,
right,
and some others. They all voted to keep the Soviet Union, but then in December, in secret and illegally, without permission from the supposed parliament, the Soviet Union was dissolved. And I think we're rushing, but maybe if we only have 1 minute, I want to pick up on how the U.S. interfered with Russian relations with the former Soviet republics, particularly in the North Caucasus. Yeah. And
maybe that would be a good place to pick up next week, because we've got about a minute left. And just so people are aware of it, if you go to Wikipedia and type in Soviet Union referendum 1991, you can see by each republic, and even the constituents of the republic, like the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic is actually a federation itself, as the name implies, and is like a dozen republics inside of that. You can see how each one of them voted for and against, and the majority of it was, you know, huge in favor of remaining inside the Soviet Union. 90%, 97.6%, if you look at the at some of them. And, overall, it was massively in favor.
Isn't that interesting? In the Asia part, beyond the Urals, it was 90%.
Yep.
And yet, the ruling elite in Tajikistan and in Uzbekistan, and not, they were the ones who were the nationalists. The people weren't.
Right.
And by the way, Ukraine approved, people in Ukraine approved staying in the Soviet Union by 80%.
That's right. And the republics, the three Baltics, their locals refused to participate. So people organized it themselves. And the results there were actually 95% in favor of staying in. And they said that the turnout was about 50%. So still, it seems like the majority of people there wanted to stay in. And so regardless of that, the nation state was disassembled. The economy was parceled out to a group of thieves. The people
about
suffered.
100.
Yeah, about 100 of them. And of course, the real thieves who were here, you know, here in the United States, looking to get the oil and gas and everything else that lies under the ground there, and the real estate, and pull these people out of the market as competitors, etc. Once all of that was accomplished, you now have Yeltsin presiding over what's left, and out of the ashes of that comes Putin. And so we'll pick up, I guess, at the beginning of the administration of Yeltsin next week, and we'll take it as far through that as we can. Luciana, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure having this discussion today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure, too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.